Up first on the local news hour this morning, we have Charlie Sturgis. He has this week's Mountain Trails Report. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning. Yeah, it's a beautiful day out. Still a little bit smoky, but hopefully the wind will come in and take care of some of that. And Lord knows if we can get some more moisture, that would be terrific. There's probably two things we probably want to talk about. One is we have to start thinking about the rut season. This is when the deer and the moose and the elk like to mate. And we did have an incident last Saturday that had someone had an injury from actually being charged by a moose. So they, you know, normally during the summer and during the heat, they're pretty docile, but during the rut, they're not docile at all. And they don't love your dogs. They don't love your patio furniture, and they don't really like you. So moose have got to be given a big buy a leeway on the trails. Don't even think about trying to kind of scare them out of the way or anything. This just won't work. Anyhow, that would be one thing. And two, you know, we are planning on officially opening the 9K trail next weekend. So that's going to be pretty exciting. It's, a lot of people have been using parts of it already. It's part of the Tour de Sud course. So definitely get out there and try that out. And certainly if you're doing the Tour de Sud, that's a great option for something other than straight uphill. And speaking of Tour de Sud, yes, we did order more socks. We were so overwhelmed with registrations, at least above our imagination, that we did order more socks, and they will be in. So if you are planning on registering, you will probably get socks. That's it. Otherwise, have a great weekend.
Great. Thank you so much, Charlie.
You betcha. Enjoy.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, the developer who is hoping to create a commercial and residential center on over 300 acres of land, a prospective annexation by the town of Hideout into Summit County, reviewed the outlines of his plans for Hideout's Planning Commission on Thursday night. As Rick Ruff reports, developer Nate Brockbank told the town planners he's aiming to negotiate with them over the details of the project.
Last week, the Hideout Town Council, for the second time in recent months, passed a resolution of intent to pursue annexation and authorized their mayor to enter into a pre-annexation agreement with developer Brockbank. Council member Jerry Dwinell told the planning commissioners that an annexation is not a certainty, but they want to explore the idea. While the state law enabling Hideout's annexation has been repealed, that action doesn't take effect until the end of October. Brockbank's plan is situated on some 350 acres extending toward Richardson Flat and Quinns Junction. A previous incarnation of the plan was 650 acres, but Brockbank said he's dropping acreage that is legally disputed by Part City or Summit County, though the developer still maintains that he's acquired the land. He said the project is located in a bowl with some of the site to the north and east, crossed by the Richardson Flat Road. Brockbank said the town center would be about 25 acres, including retail, restaurants, and a grocery store. The plan also includes some 497 residential units.
Single-family lots, different size lots, and townhomes, different style of townhomes. We want to try to meet all the, you know, hit different pricing. You know, the Ivory subdivision is just down the street from us. They have homes in the $2 million price range, and they also have some moderate income homes. We want to hit all different prices. That will be different style of homes, the $500,000 price range up to the $1 million price range.
He added he had previously planned to develop 297 workforce units on a parcel across Highway 248 to the north, but that's one of the legally disputed properties he dropped. However, Brockbank said there is a huge need for affordable housing, and he could include it in the current housing plan if the Hideout planners are interested. He said his plan includes a possible school site, and just this week he decided to add a location for a church. Brockbank said that ultimately the project will have 15 miles of trails, and as an important benefit, they will link up to the rail trail.
With my other developments that I'm doing in the town, you'll be able to get from basically the town of Hideout all the way into Park City without getting on a highway or even just riding your bike. And then you'll also be able to get to Deer Valley just riding your bike on an asphalt trail, which I think is amazing. With the trail system we're doing here and the parks and the commercial and, you know, the school and the church, we're just adding a lot to the whole, not just Hideout, but we think the whole community.
The prospective annexation is in the vicinity of the Superfund site at Richardson Flat, known technically as OU1. Brodbank said he has never been interested in annexing that land. He assured Hideout officials that they would not bear a financial liability for cleanup of any contamination. He said there will be continual monitoring of the development site. Any contaminated material will be taken to Tooele or another off-site location.
I've done a phase one report and a phase two report. I've done a phase one and phase two on everything that says not annexing. I've done a phase one report on everything else. So I have six phase one reports on the stuff that we are still trying to annex into the town. And those have come back clean. But because of the OU1 site that's in the area, we will have someone on site checking the soils every time we did.
Developer Nate Brockbank. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.
Well, on the phone with me, I have Andrea Himoff, the Executive Director of Action Utah, here to talk about the number of virtual events they're hosting this fall to inform voters on their ballots and a number of other political issues. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about you and the work Action Utah does.
Yeah. Action Utah has been around since 2016, and we're a nonpartisan community advocacy organization that's empowering Utahns from both sides of the aisle to get civically engaged and impact the issues you care about. So we do that through a number of ways. We provide tools and resources, community advocacy skill training, a lot of informative events like these, and we're really working hard right now to get out the vote for the November election during this season.
Mm-hmm. And what is this What's on Your Ballot discussion that's happening on Thursday? You'll be talking about education funding?
We talked about education funding last night in our What's on Your Ballot series. There's four events that are happening. This was the second in our series. And this was a panel discussion with folks from both sides of the issue and both sides of the aisle discussing one of the largest of the seven constitutional amendment questions that will appear on statewide ballots this year, Constitutional Amendment G. And this particular question asks voters whether a pot of money that comes from income tax revenues, which has been constitutionally earmarked only for education spending, should also be shared with expenses for children and people with disabilities. And it's an extremely complicated issue that stems from the same budget imbalance problems that legislators attempted to tackle last year or for the past 2 years with tax reform. But at the heart of the issue is also a continued concern about how this measure would impact education funding in a state that traditionally underfunds education. So we really wanted to get people together to talk about it from all perspectives in order to inform voters and help them cast an informed vote on this issue in November.
Mm-hmm. And why this issue in particular? Why not choose something else?
Well, we have chosen two of the constitutional amendments to highlight with greater discussion that are the more complicated ones. We held on September 2nd a discussion around Constitutional Amendment C. It's called What's on Your Ballot? Removing Slavery from the Utah Constitution. And that is an issue that people can misunderstand as well. There is language in our Utah Constitution that permits slavery under the condition that it is used as a punishment for crime. And that is a very old piece of language being removed from state constitutions across the country, and even there's an effort to remove it from the United States Constitution. In Utah, legislators voted unanimously to put this on the ballot because they say, wow, it's beyond time to do that. So we held that already, and we have a video available of that event for voters to go and look at anytime to better understand that issue. But in addition, we're holding our next event on September 30th on all seven of the constitutional amendment questions so that people can really understand all seven of them. And our final event will be October 15th about who's on your ballot, which is about the candidates, what type of candidates you can expect to see, and how to learn more about them so that you can really cast a vote up and down the ballot for every person and measure on your ballot.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about those events. How can people get involved, and what kind of turnout have you been seeing for the events so far?
Yeah, people have been really interested in these questions because it's hard to find information out about them, actually. And this is one of the great ways. Folks can sign up for our events in advance on actionutah.org's event page. We also have event listings on our Facebook page. The handle is at actionutah. And they can go to those places to see the videos after the events as well, because we want them to be as publicly accessible as possible. So anytime, come to actionutah.org or our social media pages at actionutah.
Awesome. So let's give us a little update on the conversation around police reform. What steps, if any, are next, and where do we go from here?
That's a really good question, and that's really why we co-hosted this panel earlier this week. It's called Coming Together on Police Reform. The goal of that event was really to bring together a wide variety of voices to talk about a complicated issue that's often misunderstood. A lot of folks kind of equate the idea of police reform with defunding the police, but the truth is that there's no credible groups in Utah, really no organized groups that are talking about defunding the police. So that was sort of left off the table in this conversation, but a whole wide range of reforms were suggested by a wide range of groups. And I think what was really interesting was that all of the groups weren't talking about if there should be police reform, but really what those reforms should look like for Utah, and also how community members need to be part of the conversation. And to do so, they need to go beyond protesting. Like, keep protesting, that's great, but also what's really needed to move policy forward is to start talking with lawmakers at the local and state levels. So those were really important ways. And that panel included the president of the Utah Chiefs Police Association, the president of NAACP Salt Lake, the chair of the Salt Lake City Council, and organizer for Utah's Against Police Brutality. So it was kind of a wide range of voices, kind of all saying the same thing in a way, and also agreeing on a lot of reforms that need to be made.
And how hard is that perception you mentioned? When people hear defund the police, they think there will be no police anywhere ever again. How hard has that perception been to break in Utah when it's just reforms?
I think it's very hard. Janetta Williams, who's the president of NAACP in Salt Lake, really lamented the fact that her organization, both in Utah and nationally, gets misunderstood as wanting that particular reform. And instead, they have a whole list of reforms they want to see, like strict police accountability, a limited use of force, limited use of racial profiling, demilitarizing the police, tracking reporting data, and so on. And none of those have to do with defunding the police. And as Chief Ross suggested in this panel, defunding police really can have a wide range of impacts, you know, from limiting funding from some police departments towards social services to eliminating police altogether. That's a wide range of suggestions that really aren't being made except by a few individuals here in Utah.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about November. The U.S. Postal Service sent out the wrong info to Utahns about mail-in voting. What was that confusion about?
It was an unfortunate impact of a well-intentioned effort. The Postal Service sent out a postcard across the country with a list of sort of generic tips for voters to ensure that their ballots would be received and mailed in time to be counted in the election. The problem is that in about 9 states, one of those suggestions doesn't apply, and Utah is one of them. The suggestion was that you have to request a mail-in ballot at least 15 days ahead of the election in order to receive one. But in Utah, that is not the procedure. And the lieutenant governor responded with a statement to alert voters that, number one, all active registered voters in Utah automatically receive their ballots in the mail. And number two, individuals do not need to request a mail-in ballot separately if they've previously registered to vote. So I think that's really important information for Utahns to know. And there's a lot of groups and a lot of leadership here pushing out the word, including Action Utah, pushing out the word that that piece of information is erroneous And you don't have to worry about requesting that mail-in ballot if you're already registered. But if you're not registered to vote, please note that the deadline to do so is October 23rd by 5 p.m. And you can register to vote online, by text, by mail, by email, or even in person where it's offered at your county clerk's office. If you go online, you can check and even update your voter registration if you've moved or changed your name at vote.utah.gov.
So will the election this year be completely by mail, or will there be some in-person voting opportunities?
Good question, Sean, because it's different for this general election than it was for the primary election. During the general election, there will be in-person early voting and election day voting polling locations offered in all counties. That's different than what happened during the primary election. Note that those in-person locations might be indoors and they might be outdoors. The county gets to decide. And they may have to limit the number of people who will be able to be at the location at once. So that can create longer lines. And election officials are really asking people to vote early, vote by mail, or put your ballot in a drop box in order to avoid long lines and safety issues on election day.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about this voter pledge. This is a way to get out the vote by getting folks to commit to voting and reminding others to do so.
That's right. Action Utah does a voter pledge every year because data shows that if people really just make a simple commitment to voting, they're more likely to cast a ballot. And that's what we want you to do, Utah. We want you to vote this year. You can go to actionutah.org to sign the voter pledge, commit to voting, and to helping others vote by reminding them to do so. And we, in turn, will send you some important election information and updates to make sure you don't miss your opportunities to register, know where you're going to vote, and know how you're going to vote.
Anything else you want to share with us this morning?
Obviously, I'm really on a voter kick right now, and just want to remind people to really participate in that. But one last thing is that I do want to remind folks in Summit County to, if you haven't already, to fill out your census forms. Census can be filled out online or by phone, and they need to be completed by the end of September. We want everyone to be counted because it really impacts funding that comes into our county and into our communities for needed services that really impact everyone. So also fill out your census.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Andrea.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good morning, 828 here at the KPCW studios in Park City, 54 degrees here in Old Town, 46 degrees in Heber. Well, the Park City City Council met for the first time since August on Thursday evening. On the phone with a recap is Councilmember Tim Henney. Councilmember, good morning.
Good morning, Sean.
All right. Well, the council back after a bit of a break. Did it feel good to get back to the city council work?
Yeah, it really did. You know, and Max Dolanly spoke to that fairly extensively during comments, but I think we all were excited to get back. And one of the things that we all felt and noticed was, you know, pre-COVID, we were doing things on behalf of the community and felt like we were making progress and moving the needle and all those sorts of things. And then COVID hit, and that became a major distraction and even a roadblock to doing the people's business, basically. And we found ourselves, along with everybody else, in the very reactive and mode of trying to stabilize and get our footing and figure out what was going to happen. And everybody had their own, you know, predictions and forecasts about what the summer was likely to be like. And then more recently, during the month of August, when we had our recess at council, we kind of got blindsided by the whole Hideout annexation, which certainly has taken a tremendous amount of energy and resource and focus. You know, Max himself and the mayor and Matt Dias have just been putting so much time and energy into that, working tirelessly with the state legislature. You know, that's where our energy went to great effect, while Summit County's energy has gone into the legal process with great effect as well. And we've had some success, but a lot of frustration there because they continue to work that annexation. But to answer your question in a short way, Sean, it was great to get back to a meeting and be focused on some of the things that, you know, we feel like are doing the people's business again.
Wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about last night's meeting. Triple Crown kicks things off. Obviously, that was a very contentious issue back in July with all these events getting canceled. Obviously, they were none too happy about it. Council discussed a year extension on their contract and then a 10-year contract for the Triple Crown tournament. Council showed a willingness to give the tournament to 2021, but there was little enthusiasm for a full 10-year contract. 10 years is a long time. Why is the council reluctant to lock in 10 more years of Triple Crown?
Well, I think your description kind of alludes to it. You just said 10 years is a long time, especially in this era of COVID. You know, we don't know what's going to be happening tomorrow, much less 10 years from now. So just the obvious is to lock the community, lock future councils into something that's 10 years long doesn't seem like a responsible thing to do. So that's, you know, we'll start right there. That's a tough hurdle to clear. And I think it's a hurdle that will not be cleared. But it goes a lot deeper than that. I mean, you know, you mentioned that it was contentious when we, you know, back in July, and Triple Crown was none too happy about, you know, some of the conditions that we would have put in place for them to be able to hold their tournament. And in fact, right up, I don't know that they ever officially canceled their tournament. I know that they did on their websites, and they did, you know, they put out information to people who had planned to come, but they never, as far as I know, they never came to the city and officially canceled their tournament, which is an interesting thing that we didn't really touch on last night, because if in fact they haven't they didn't cancel the 2020, tournament officially, then maybe they don't have the ability to ask for an extension, because really all we're doing, we think at this point, is making an exception for COVID, like we have done with a lot of other businesses, a lot of other events. And we have said, because COVID is something far outside of anybody's ability to control or to forecast, you know, we should make exceptions and make allowances and be supportive. But, you know, I think right now the council's view is that it makes sense to let them come back under the existing contract in 2021. But I'll tell you what, beyond that, everything is up for discussion.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying the council will be more receptive to perhaps a shorter contract, 5 years, more or less?
I don't know, Sean. I don't know that I'd even be willing to say that, quite honestly. Steve Joyce kind of laid out one end of the conversation, which is he doesn't believe that Triple Crown necessarily fits within the community after all the work that has been done with the SEAC committee a couple of years ago. You know, they ranked these events and they tried to put some criteria on the events to help our event team and the council make the tough decisions about what events we were going to permit in the future and which ones we were not. And it wasn't just which ones we were going to permit. It was which ones are we going to cut. And guess what event was at the bottom of the list? It was this one. So, you know, that's a position that Steve has articulated extremely well and laid it out last night. On the other side, Max Dwelny, who's a small business owner and a lifelong resident of Park City, laid out equally compelling argument on the benefits of Triple Crown, not just the economic benefits, which, you know, a lot of people have stated those that have an economic stake in Triple Crown tend to support it, but also beyond that, the social equity component, which Max spoke to, I think, quite effectively, that it brings a different sort of visitor to Park City that we don't normally see. And he thinks that's good for the community, and it's good for his children and other children to see the type of people that come for Triple Crown in the parade, and who doesn't like a parade. But, you know, it's very nuanced, and we've got a lot of issues as far as how often we shut down Main Street and who we shut it down for, and then who pays the cost. That was something that Nan Worrell spoke to very effectively also. We've given fee waivers of, you know, $50,000 to the Triple Crown. We have a local tournament, the Extreme Soccer, that gets, you know, something like $2,500. So how is that fair when we have a local organization that's a nonprofit and we support them to the tune of $2,500, and we have a profit motive profit-driven and profit-motive event that comes to town, and we waive fees in excess of $50,000. So there's a lot to unpack there. This was the beginning of that unpacking, and it'll come back for further discussion.
Mm-hmm. So to strike that balance, who needs to be in the room for that? Would it be City Council, Historic Park City Alliance, and Triple Crown trying to strike that balance?
Well, I'll tell you, those are the folks that are in the room. You know, the ones that are in the room right now are, you know, some of the lodging firms that have benefited from Triple Crown through the years. And they're making the argument about the economic driver and how they're able to employ people during the summer that they might not otherwise be able to employ. So that's a strong argument. You know, HPCA is in the room already. The Chamber Bureau is in the room already or at the table. I think what we need to hear from our community members, you know, because that's really the rub. The rub is there a place for an event that comes and uses the community as a venue, which is somewhat extractive? I think that's the negative argument, is that they're extracting value from the community at the expense of the community as a burden to the community, versus, you know, what they add from an economic driver and maybe a social equity perspective. And that was kind of a new one that, you know, I liked hearing that from Max. I always appreciate his perspective, and I thought he really dropped that aspect in that I hadn't really been considering before. So viewing it through the social equity lens. And so we need to hear from the community where this, you know, kind of where they land on this. And so far we haven't really had that, but again, last night was the first opportunity, and we'll hope to hear more from people as we continue to discuss this. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's probably not going to be resolved right away. This is going to be an ongoing conversation. We've got some time to work on this.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about these cluster mailboxes and the issues of delivering mail in Old Town Park City. One member of the public said they've seen this conversation play out over the last 30 years. Will cluster mailboxes finally solve the problems of mail in Old Town, or is there more that still needs to be done?
Well, I don't, you know, cluster mailboxes, I don't think necessarily solve the problem. There's no simple, easy solution, or that would have been done. We'd already be doing it. And the problem is that Old Town has been determined as a deliverable area by the post office, which means that you either have to have a post office box at the end of your driveway, or you have to have cluster boxes in locations that people can then, you know, walk to, ride to, drive to, and have fewer than you would have if you had mailboxes at the end of everybody's driveway. And that negates the need for mailboxes at the post office. But there are significant logistical problems with either one of those. I mean, we can't put mailboxes at the end of driveways in Park City and have snowplows going down the road. Anybody who has been in Old Town during a winter that has anything that's normal or significant snowfall, you know that is not going to work. All of those mailboxes will be taken out by snowplows or run over by cars, and there's a lot of street parking. We already have tons of issues. And I would say the same thing applies with the gang boxes, with the cluster mailboxes. As soon as one or two of those gets hit by a snowplow, and they're not cheap, and the burden would be borne by the city and the taxpayers, we'll be spending a lot of money maintaining and replacing those mailboxes. So that's the problem, and the option that we're gravitating toward, and I think we're going to, you know, that we're taking a strong look at, is subsidizing the cost of mailboxes at the Main Street Post Office for what we think is something like 200 to 300 Old Town residents, that was the direction that we gave last night.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about these HOAs versus primary residences. I think you decided that HOAs would have to apply and pay for these boxes on their own, but primary residences would be compensated by the city. Some members of the public seem to think that the USPS should be paying for some of this and not the city.
Well, my understanding is that discussion came up sometime in the not too distant past, let's say within the last 15 years, might have been 10, 12, 15 years ago, and a past council determined that that they didn't want to install cluster mailboxes, which at the time the offer was to do that at the expense of the post office. The post office was going to pay for the installation, the maintenance, and the upkeep. And that offer is no longer available. It's not on the table because of the previous process and denial by the council. So here we are now. We don't have the option of having the post office pay for it. So we did leave on the table that if there are HOAs that determine on their property at their expense, they would like to install cluster boxes, that, you know, that's an option that we would certainly explore on a case by case basis. So that is something that is available.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on and talk a little bit about this housing resolution updates. You had a joint discussion with the Park City Planning Commission, and we're considering proposed amendments to the 2017 housing resolution, which looks to further mitigate the impacts of new development on affordability of housing in Park City. Affordability seems to be a really important topic for you and your colleagues, especially for the workers the city needs but may actually be priced out of living in the area. What do these amendments do to make housing more accessible in Park City?
Well, this is, you know, this is the ongoing boogeyman for Park City, and I think a lot of very appealing destination and just communities, not even destination communities, but appealing communities across the country and probably around the world. You know, our median home price in Park City is in excess of $2 million. That's inside city limits. And that $2 million was a year ago. And with COVID and the recent boom in home sales and all the inventories gone, you know, what happens next is prices go up. So I haven't seen the figure, but somebody at the Board of Realtors could probably provide that. And it wouldn't surprise me if we were in the 2.2, maybe even all the way up to 2.5 million median home price in Park City. So that prices a lot of people out of living in Park City. And that if unchecked or without a counterweight or a counterbalance, will result in a community of only extremely affluent people and no one else. So if we want to have a whole and complete and healthy community, then, you know, there is an obligation on someone's part to provide housing that is affordable to more than just the extremely wealthy, and the private sector will not do it. So all that, and nor should the private sector do it, because the private sector is profit motivated. The only way that that the private sector will provide affordable housing is through inclusionary zoning, and we have that. So we've had it at 15%, and the discussion last night was taking that inclusionary zoning up to 20% and possibly even 25%. But that would broaden the net a little bit. And then the other part of the discussion was how to broaden the net to include more properties, more projects, more development, and how could we include even large single-family residences that aren't already covered under a master plan development, which most of them are, and we identified that there are only probably 80 or so opportunities to do so. But the whole idea is to broaden the net to have more development, more building, help pay for what we believe is an obligation to provide some affordable housing. And because the private sector won't do it based on the profit motivation, other than the regulation that creates an obligation, who's going to do that? Well, it's going to be, you know, your local government and your taxpayer funds. It's not the city council that has this as a critical priority. It's the community that has this as a critical priority. And it's been getting more critical for the last 30 years or the 28 years that I've lived here, and probably, you know, beyond that, to the point where it's acute at this point. But it's helping us achieve our goal of 800 units, you know, and I can't remember off the top of my head, maybe 70 or 75 that we've completed thus far. And we've got another 250 identified and in the works and, you know, in process, I would call it. And then we have a fairly significant gap. But we're looking at every single opportunity and option to claw back, I would say, and to repurpose some land and some housing to be community benefit land and housing.
Mm-hmm. Real quick before we go, I do want to touch on this Park Avenue redesign. So the Park Avenue is scheduled for reconstruction in 2 years, and council looked at a variety of proposals last night and ultimately decided on a configuration for the street that would combine curbside parking and a dedicated uphill bike lane. What did the council like about this particular option?
Well, the particular option was arrived at with a lot of input from different departments, engineering, parking, transportation planning, and the police department. So I would say we relied upon the comments from our experts to arrive at that as the preferred option. But the whole thing is basically that we just did a Surrey seal on Park Avenue. And so we have a clean slate, and with paint, which, you know, is not a huge expense. It's not, infrastructure, which, as you mentioned, will be done in the future at some point when we do a complete rebuild. We get to, test a proof of concept. So that's what we're doing. We're taking a concept of can Park Avenue be repurposed to more walkability, more pedestrian, less single occupancy car, rearranging the parking, eliminating it from one side of the street, putting in residential permit parking to prioritize the residences who don't have off-street parking options. And can we do that with minimum expense at this moment in time? And we have a great opportunity to do that. So this is a temporary test and trying to test a concept, and we will learn an awful lot from it. We even talked about the possibility of making Park Avenue one way, as we did during the Sundance Film Festival last year, which I think worked with great success. And everybody seemed to initially, kind of be skeptical. And after the fact, the feedback we got was that it was absolutely phenomenal, especially for the residents who, found that they could get up and down Park Avenue because they had access in both directions, as well as transit, but everybody else had a one way. So that kind of thing, we tested it during Sundance and we learned a lot, and we're going to test this fall and next year, and we hope to learn a lot, and that'll help us arrive at a much better final product and design when we do the whole rebuild for Park Avenue, which will be a great opportunity.
Wonderful. Well, we've got to leave it right there. Councilmember Henney, thank you so much.
Okay, Sean, my pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, good morning. It is 8:48. I'm Sean Higgins in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. The Park City Institute presents Susan Vega for a virtual show next month. In the studio with details is Executive Director of the Institute, Ari Ioannidis. Good morning, Ari.
Good morning. My first time speaking with you, Sean. Welcome to KPCW.
Thank you so much. So tell us how this is going to work. Do you pay per link or a set fee?
Oh, that's a great question. Going straight for the money. Well, first of all, let me back up. Suzanne Vega, these type of online experiences are kind of tough. This one's unique in that she released an album on September 11th, New York's Stories, Songs and Stories, which is kind of a retrospective of her career, and they re-recorded all the albums in a small setting, sort of live. So not necessarily in front of a live audience, but they played it live, which is rare these days. Normally, especially with some Suzanne Vega songs, they're very produced. And what they're doing is in October, performing live at the Blue Note to kind of celebrate the release of this album. So since we had Suzanne Vega in the past on our stage, like we did with Jeff Daniels in the past, we thought it'd be interesting to make this opportunity available for our patrons. The great news is the tickets are only $20. There's no upfront fee for the Institute, and half of those funds come back to the Institute. So, we sell 100 tickets. Easy math, we make $1,000.
So are other art organizations also able to provide the link so their patrons can tune in?
They can. I mean, anybody can pick up the link. So we have an email going out to our 17,000 patrons today with the link. It is on our Facebook page, so it's there as well. You can go to parkcityinstitute.org, and there's a link right there. So anyone who shares that link through any of the organizations are more than welcome to do so. And once again, ticket sales will benefit the Institute.
And you mentioned that this will be a live show on the 7th, or is this pre-recorded and streamed?
It is a live show. So she's got a great kind of all-star band with her. And, as a music fan, we can never provide this experience at the Eccles. It'd have to be like at the Black Box. But I personally would love, I've been to the Blue Note in New York. It's a great venue, but the ability to be able to kind of peek in on a performance live there, I mean, we're not going to fly in a jet. We're not going to walk down the streets of New York to the Blue Note to see this show during COVID. But the ability to be able to see such a great performer, Grammy Award-winning performer, do some wonderful songs in a different way at the Blue Note, I think is an exceptional opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned you're going to be sending out an email about this, but how do you register and how much would that cost?
Yeah, if you go to the website, so parkcityinstitute.org, you would simply click on the button. It's just like buying a ticket, but it's a live stream ticket. You'll go to a site, $20, I think, plus $4 handling fee or something, and then you'll get a link to the live stream. Now, she performs at 9 o'clock Eastern, but it's 7 o'clock Mountain. You'll be able to watch that live. And we got a preview video from a Paris show. It's really stunning. I mean, it's not like anything you would see online, because you can go on YouTube and see, you know, music videos and performances by a lot of people. But this one is a very unique experience.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other shows you can announce right now?
I can tell you it's very interesting. So it's kind of like juggling. First of all, you know, the theater's basically closed, which is a shame. You know, 1,200 seat theater, we could put on 300 or 200 seat performances pretty easily. But the school district's primary focus has to be the safety and health of their team and their students. So I understand their reluctance to allowing anyone outside the district to hold any events at school. So that makes a lot of sense. But we have scheduled the entire main stage season. We've had a couple of folks call us and say they would prefer not to show. So we're ready once we go to the green level to hold shows. We unfortunately were unable to host Black Violin this summer. We did arrange to get them back next summer. So one of the things I miss most is the student outreach we've been able to do. And Black Violin, virtuoso string performers, we're planning to do a whole curriculum tie-in with student outreach, which I was excited about. Parsons Dance was another group. We're trying to get them back. And what's interesting, if you go to our Facebook page, and this ties back to the student outreach, they have every one of their members has posted like 20-minute classes, dance classes. Some of them are as easy as, you know, a stretching warm-up. One of them is yoga, but some of them are pretty advanced. Everything from hip hop to ballet, there's ballroom dancing. I think last time I counted, there were over 100 of these videos. Some of them are also live, so you can look and see. I think there was a great one last night. So if you go to our Facebook page or you go to Parsons Dance website, you can participate in this outreach. And they're really fun to watch. I'm not really a dancer, but they're really very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of some of these events you mentioned, the Egyptian Theater held some shows this spring with social distancing in place, and the film series is also hoping to allow up to 65 patrons back into the Jim Sanity Auditorium this winter. Since Egyptian Theater is the biggest venue in town, would it mean the most people could be socially distanced in one venue? Is that green face set in stone?
As far as I'm concerned with the school district, from what I'm hearing, yes. We would love to be able to host. And you're right. The Eccles is the largest theater in town. It is a community theater. The Park City Institute raised over a third of the funds to build and outfit that theater. Things like the balcony, the improved seating, all those things are a result of our fundraising efforts. So it would be wonderful. And Randy and I had talked about maybe holding some of their shows in the Eccles, because we can socially distance very easily. You know, the Egyptian's roughly 300 and something seats, and, you know, we're easily four times that. So we would love to have been able to do that. But unfortunately, you know, we share, you know, it's a school auditorium. At the end of the day, it's a fancy one. And it has led to some problems. Sundance was unable to commit because we did not know if by Sundance that venue would be available for him. That is, I think, together with the Egyptian Theater, one of the iconic venues for Sundance. So it's a shame that we're unable to hold those events there, but it's just a reality of COVID.
Mm-hmm. So how have you been able to stay in business? Is this money out of your pocket or coming from somewhere else?
Out of my pocket. That's funny. I would say that performing arts in general nationwide have really struggled. When you can't hold shows, it's tough. And I'm new at this. I started in March. So I've relied heavily on Brian Richards, Randy Barton, all the other execs of the performing arts community, and we're all hit very, very hard. And this it's an existential crisis. It really is. For us not to be able to hold shows, because so many of our patrons, including Brian Richards, are used to kind of a transactional giving process. So you give us a certain amount of money, we'll give you premier seats for an outdoor concert. You'll see your name in the program. Your name will be on the series, for instance, St. Regis. And we're just unable to do that without shows. So about a month ago, we started a really kind of a campaign to kind of get that word out. We reached out to several of the organizations here in Summit County and all of our patrons. We created a kind of a flashy video, and it worked. I sent out an email to our patrons, and they stepped up. And these are patrons who, I want to tell you, didn't ask for anything in return and helped sustain us. So we've all cut back. I know for our part, we've cut our expenses down 94%, which is a big, big number. So it doesn't take much to sustain us so that we can be ready to produce shows once we're able to do it. Basically, we have a staff of two. There's me and Jenny, who's just phenomenal. And we've been able to continue the operations of the organization and stay relevant and produce these online shows. And I just really want to thank those patrons who stepped up. We will remember them when we're able to get going again. And I do want to have a shout out. Promontory has a had stepped up and set up a sustaining arts fund and gave money to a lot of the organizations in town. So it will help the arts be sustained.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk that not every arts organization might make it through this tough time. Do you think the Institute will?
Yeah, there was a time when I didn't think it would. I took over. We were financially strapped. But I would say a lot of our patrons stepped up in a big way and either forgave loans or helped us bridge that gap. That we were also able to renegotiate every bill that was due and get all those paid off. I think we have one major bill that needs to get paid. Other than that, we're in pretty good shape. We had a very large infusion of cash from about 30 of our patrons who stepped up. We sent an email out. And then we had a donor come up and match all of those donations. So with the cash we have right now, and the PPP loan that we received, and the other kind of the state of Utah has stepped up in a big way through the museums. We're good right now through the end of the year. And if we continue to get donations and folks continue to see shows like the Suzanne Vega show, we'll easily make it until COVID. Yeah, so I think you can count on the Park City Institute being here ready to put on those shows when it's time.
Happy to hear it. Anything else you want to share?
No, I think that's it. Please attend the show. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Wonderful. Well, that is Ari Ioannidis with the Park City Institute. Ari, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You've been listening to the Local News Hour. I am Sean Higgins sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. It is 9 o'clock.